I didn't have the strength within me to do it. I was just too deep in the eating disorder. Like, I needed that 24/7 care. Like, I needed the nurses and I needed that support to get to a dinner table and, you know, like, lift a fork, you know, like, things that have become so alien to me that up until that point, like, I couldn't imagine doing.
To dive right in, I want to ask you how you would describe an eating disorder, because there is men and women listening to this who have never experienced it or known anybody to actually have dealt with an eating disorder. So how would you describe what that feels like, having gone through it?
I think for me, I describe it like a person being split in two. So for me, it's like there's me who's healthy, is perfect, there's Jess, and then there's the side of me that's the eating disorder, where I make choices that I think now that I'm more into a path of recovery that I can see aren't helpful. But at the time, when you're deep within the the eating disorder, they feel quite normal. They help in a way. It is very much about control and having that one thing within your life that's very predictable, and having, I suppose, being on top of that, like, no one else can be on top of it. You know, like, in anyone's life, food is the one constant. And I think that's how I describe it for me. And then with certain behaviors and stuff, they just add into the eating disorder. They help that sort of, they kind of, for me, it grounded me within the world when I felt like I wasn't safe, when things just felt a bit like spiraling, a bit crazy. You know, like, I just couldn't feel safe. I suppose that's how I'd describe it, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, it's so
tricky, yeah.
So the word control, so do you feel like you latched on to the eating disorder as a way of controlling your environment, as a kind of like a safety net that you could always kind of hold on to and go back to?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, I suppose a good example of that is because I was in treatment this time last year, and when I came out of treatment, my life very much felt like it was out of control. I had expectations to come out of hospital and things would be as they were before I went in, but obviously everyone else moved on with their lives, and I came out and I expected things to go a certain way, and that's not what happened. So at that point, I just clutched straight back onto the eating disorder, which completely defeated the whole point of having been in treatment anyway. But I just didn't know any other way to cope with it. And that's what I would have leaned on in the past, with things like when, like, changing school. So that transition from leaving cert to college, or in my final year of college, there was the whole, because I had done a series of add-ons. So we expected to do an add-on to a level 4, and that didn't happen. And that was the point where my eating disorder just completely went out of control, because I didn't know what was happening within my life. Like, I didn't know what the next level was. Like, I thought, like, I was going ahead in college in September, and that's not what happened. So that's where my eating disorder would be set off a lot. Like, even with lockdown, not knowing what was going to happen, that set things off a lot as well, you know.
And so, so with people who have developed eating disorders, you know, like yourself, do you trace back to a certain moment where this all started? And then it's kind of like, what it sounds like to me that you're saying is that there's consistent events, inconsistent events that kind of encourage it, or kind of, you know, really kind of, you know, excel the eating disorder.
Yeah, I think, like, for me to look back on it, I would see a whole, I think of it as like a recipe for disaster. There was various things that just kept adding up on top of each other, and this is where it eventually led to. Like, when I was younger, so when I was in, I would have been second year, third year in secondary school. So I was about 14, 15, like, I was bullied quite badly. And then from that, I developed anxiety, which then led on to going further within school and not feeling comfortable, not feeling, you know, like, how would you describe it? That, you know, I just didn't relate to anyone else. Like, I just couldn't function because of the anxiety, which I didn't know what it was at the time. And then when it came to moving on to college, like, I started getting more wary around food, and in my head I could see that that was something that nobody else could interfere with. It was just for me. And as time went on, it added to the point where I think with eating disorders there's a perception that you look a certain way, but my eating disorder was simmering there in the background for many years before it became very visible to those around me, if you get what I mean. So, like, it was always just floating there, but it was never enough for people to be concerned.
So you don't, so you didn't always associate your eating disorder, or maybe never, with how you looked, or that was never a starting point for you?
No, that was never the set point for it. I think as time went on, it definitely did. But from the get-go, it was never that. It was just something that I could have that nobody else could have. Nobody else could interfere with. It was just mine, and that was it. And it was me and food and me and exercise. And that was, you know, that was it. Like, it was my one thing.
Yeah. And then, so you're saying that when before kind of it was visible to people around you, say, or it was more, you know, kind of, they were more aware of your eating disorder, but you had known it, that it was in the background all along, or for a long time prior to that. What kind of things, behaviors did you see that changed in yourself at that time to try and kind of gain control?
Yeah, for me, I became very picky around various things I was eating. So that became very limited very fast. You know, like, I went from being quite a good, solid appetite and being very strict about what I was eating. And I think that's where it was picked up on by family. And then, like, things with being excessive around exercise, you know, having a Fitbit, being excessive about that. There was just all these things that I just started jumping onto as a means of control around. Then it became very much, not to go into weight, because I don't think that's important to talk about, but towards the end, it became very much about controlling that number. But up to that point, it was just all these little behaviors that was making me feel safe within it. So if I did these things, I knew it was good at the end of the day that I had done X, Y, and Z. My eating disorder was so happy with me. And, like, I was going to bed wrecked, but in my head, my eating disorder was happy, as opposed to a day where if I didn't fulfill what the eating disorder wanted, I'd be going to bed thinking, oh, I haven't done this, I haven't done that. And it became a very stress type thing where I knew that wasn't right. So that was how I picked up on that. I knew something wasn't very healthy, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. And so how long are we talking? Are we talking 4 years, 5 years? How long has this been, you've been experiencing this?
In total, I would say 11 years, and then 5 years before everyone around me started to realize, and before it got worse in the last 5 years. But before that, it was just, I think it was what they had said to me was I was a functioning anorexic, so I was functioning quite well in life. It wasn't interfering until up to 5 years ago, when it did start to interfere. It became, you know, it was too much for my body to withstand, and it was too much for me. It was stressing me out, and it was, you know, it was impacting my mood. It was increasing the anxiety, which I had initially, it was helping with it, so it became more and more.
Yeah. And the turning point, so there's obviously a turning point there, but I'm sure there was some low kind of moments in that span of 11 years, you know, whether you're functioning or not functioning anorexic. Can you talk about those low moments, and maybe people that are listening might be able to relate to, you know, some really low moments that maybe at the time you felt you should get on with it, or you felt you tried to cope with it, but looking back, it was like a huge warning sign for you?
Yeah, I think a big thing for me was being in college and not wanting to go out with my friends, because I didn't want to have to deal with, like, things like alcohol and things like that, or, you know, like the post night out at Supermax. You know, everyone goes around to Supermax, they get their takeaway. So, like, I was avoiding all of this fun experience at college because I didn't want to have to deal with that, because you know, like, it's Irish night out, everyone, you know, Supermax is fantastic, you know, that's where you're going to end up. And I went out of my way to avoid that. I went out of my way to avoid birthday meals with my friends, just things like that, you know, like the fun things now that I crave to do, and, like, we can't because of restrictions and stuff. But at the time, and looking back, and then as well with the added pressure of social media, I was missing out on all of these things, and then seeing it on, like, Snapchat and stuff. And then I'm sitting at home berating myself because I'm not there. But on the one hand, had I gone, I would have been upset at myself because I'd have gone and had the meal. So, like, there's little things like that, missing out on things with my friends, just not doing things because food was going to be, you know, it was going to be a thing that was going to be there. And even, like, because I would have blogged throughout the years, I avoided going to events and stuff because of the food aspect of being there and things like that. You know, it interfered and ruined so many amazing opportunities I had and so many good times I would have had with my friends just for nothing, really, when I look back on it. And it is really depressing to think about it now, how much I've missed out on because of it. But going forward in my life, I'm very much I'm making sure I do everything now, living life to the fullest type thing.
Yeah. And so you were kind of avoiding any social situations with food. It wasn't a case of you would go and you would resist temptation.
Yeah.
You know, being a functioning anorexic, but it was more a case of, you know, you would just not go completely.
Yeah. Like a handful of times that I would have gone, say, to someone's, I suppose around the time when this all kicked off, like 18th, you know, people's 18th, and there'd be so much food and there'd be so much alcohol. Like, I would pick and choose who I was going to for how it would make them feel. So depending on how close to them I was, so I wouldn't upset like my closest friends by not going to their birthday because I was afraid to eat birthday cake. And like, even like on my own birthdays, like, I couldn't tell you the last time I properly celebrated my birthday just because of like food and stuff. Like, it's really, when you think about it, it's really heartbreaking, but at the time it makes sense to you to avoid all these situations.
Yeah. And what, at the time, you know, when you're saying, no, I can't go again, no, I have this, or you're using whatever excuse to say that you can't go, what kind of reaction are you getting at your friends and family? Are they too busy to kind of even put the puzzle pieces together, you know, because you're still functioning? And are they like, oh, maybe she's shy, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of it boiled down to, so, you know, like, you'd make, I used to make a lot of plans with my friends to go out for coffee and stuff, and then the day would come and I was like, no, that's not going to happen. I was like, I can't, like, deal with whatever there. And I'd text and be like, oh, sorry, I'm not feeling really well, I can't go. And I think a lot of it, they boil down to anxiety, but really it was just a way of avoiding dealing with food and things like that. So they put up with it. Like, I'm very blessed with my friends that none of them have been like, well, I'm not putting up with her anymore, like, she cancels this, that, and the other. Like, I think they recognized something was wrong, but they didn't know what it was, so they kind of blew it off as stress. You know, like, she's anxiety, she's a bit shy, she's a bit quiet, like, we'll just, whatever. There was never, not said to my face anyway, but there was never anything said, really.
Yeah, well, that's good. And your parents and your, you know, brothers or sisters, were they all understanding, or was it something that you spoke about openly within the family, or was it still kind of very, you know, kind of like the elephant in the room almost?
I think it was until I sought treatment, so that was 5 years ago, it was very much the elephant in the room. It was never really brought up. It was my mum who started saying it after a friend had gone to her, and then it kind of just escalated from there. And it was kind of from hearing what my mum was saying that led to me going to my GP, like, so that was where it all kicked off there. So it was just that one friend who had paid enough attention, who went to my mum, who then said something to me, who kind of made me reflect, which is where it led to me getting treatment.
And what was that like, going to, deciding to go, or even debating, talking about going to the GP? What was that like?
Oh, it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. Like, I think back on it now and I'm like, how did I do that? Like, I don't know, because I remember at the time you didn't have to book to go into your GP. You just walked in. So I walked in and I sat there. It was after Christmas. It was the first Monday they were reopened. Like, I remember it so clear. And I went in there and I sat there for so long. And I was like hemming and hawing over what I was going to say, because I was like, what do I say? I was like, because in my mind I had, I suppose, the stereotypical view to me of how someone with an eating disorder looked. And I was like, oh, I don't fit that criteria. I was like, I'm fine. Like, it's nothing to be worried about. It's just like stress. And I got in there and I spoke to my GP, and my GP is fabulous. Like, there was no messing around with her. She was straight off. She referred me on to the mental health clinic. But I went in and I said to her, I was like, you know, I think something's not right. I says, my mum's saying this, my friends have said that. I was like, maybe they're right. I was like, I feel a bit stressed. I was like, maybe it's worth talking to someone about this. I says, I'm not sure what's going on. So from there, she referred me on. Like, there was no sitting around with it. Like, she was very, you know, she was like she did her job, like she was amazing, and she has done since that day. But it is really hard to do that, and a lot of people don't know how to do that because they don't know what to say. Even me, like, I didn't know what to say, and sometimes I think about it and I'm like, if that was to happen now, what even would I say? It's very, very complicated. And I think if people have family behind them, someone who can go with them to the GP and perhaps just sit there beside them and speak and say what they're seeing, I think that could help in a way if they don't feel strong enough to voice it themselves if they're looking for help. But for me, that was how I did it.
And so this initial outreach to get help, you know, was kind of primarily, it wasn't, you know, your own doing. You had a little bit of a push from close people around you. Were you going into that saying, I don't know if I can do this? Like, even as you went and spoke to somebody in a mental health clinic, and you were you thinking in the back of your head, it'll be easier if I just pull out now?
Yeah, because in my head, I thought there was nothing wrong. Like, I didn't think, I kind of thought they were reading too much into it. Like, I didn't think it needed to escalate to the point where I needed to go to my GP or needed to go to the mental health clinic.
But so you're still in denial at this point, even though you're getting help.
Massively in denial. And on the one side of me, I think as well, it goes back to that, how I see the eating disorder. There's the one side of me that was like, okay, well, yeah, no, there, like, maybe there is something here. Like, it's worth just looking into and making sure everything's all right. But then there's the side of me that is the eating disorder and is like, no, like, you're fine. Like, they're just reading too much into it. Like, just carry on as you are. Like, it's okay. And I think it's trying to quiet down that side of your head and listen to the healthy part of your head and know that point, that part of you is just trying to manipulate you into staying ill. And I think that part of me was very, very loud at that time and just couldn't allow me to even engage in treatment, because when I had started engaging in treatment, I was still very much within my eating disorder and things went downhill very, very fast. And I thought, oh, I'm fine. Like, I'm in with a therapist, I'm seeing a psychiatrist, it's like, I'm okay, like, it's fine. And like, it really, really was not fine. I was so massively in denial despite having pursued treatment at that point in time. So yeah, it's all very
it's a very, very tough step. And when you say, you know, you weren't fine, what do you mean? Do you mean you were up all night thinking about all the things that you hadn't done or that you had to do? Or were you just so tired and fatigued? Or were you just overcome with anxiety? Or what kind of things were you saying, God, I can't cope with this anymore?
Yeah, a massive part was because I was in college, so it was getting up, you know, the 7 o'clock morning to commute over and not being home till 7. I just didn't have the energy to do it because I didn't have the fuel to get me through that day. So I started missing loads of college, and I had a lecturer at the time, and she got on to me after I missed some time, and she was like, Jess, like, is everything okay? You haven't been here in a while. So it was interfering with that. I just didn't have the energy for it. I didn't have the energy for studying. And that was stressing me out because I was in, like, I was in what would become my final year. And then just having to go to college and be around the canteen, the cafeteria, the trips to Costa, those, you know, the normal things that you're doing when you're in college that are fun. Yeah. Like, to me, they weren't fun. They were very much the enemy that I had to avoid. It was a very tough time those last few months in college. Like, and because I started becoming so unwell, when it came to repeating an exam, like, I didn't have it in me to study for the exam, and it became a thing where I had to repeat that exam 6 times because I just did not have the mental capacity to repeat that exam, and graduated after 2 years later than everyone else in my year. Like, so it took, like, the eating disorder took a lot away from me, but, you know, there was just so much difficulties with it. But I think a lot of people would see someone with an eating disorder and think, oh, they're quite perfectionist, they're really studious, like, they do quite well in exams. But for me, that wasn't it. I didn't have the calories there, and I just couldn't focus and things like that. So it became very, very difficult where college was concerned. And because I was working as well on the side, like, so I was burning the candles at both ends whilst trying to deal with this and telling myself, no, it's fine. But, like, it wasn't. Like, I was completely burning out.
And When you, so for anybody listening that might be thinking, oh, this girl, you know, she's gone through something similar to me, or a mother or a daughter, or a friend or a sister or a son, or, you know, anybody.
Yeah.
So when you go and get in Ireland, you know, I mean, we're talking about Ireland specifically here. You go in, you get treatment, you speak to your GP. Your GP was wonderful.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, some of us don't feel as comfortable with our GPs, and you know, that's okay too.
Yeah.
What's the next step after that in Ireland for treatment? Do you go to the GP, check if you're underweight, and they said, oh, you know, do they listen to more what you said, or do they look at your vitals and your weight and things like that, and kind of say, yeah, everything is way off here, you know, you're lacking.
Yeah, just to I suppose to compare my route with what I would consider the traditional route from having spoke to others. So for me, I went to the GP. My GP was fabulous. Like, she's been my GP since my early teens. So like, I had quite a good relationship with her anyway. And she didn't weigh me. She didn't do my blood. She didn't do anything like that. She was like, straight off, the referral was sent to the mental health center here where I live. And I was waiting, I'd say, only 6 weeks. So at that time, that was 5 years ago, so 2015. So I was quite fortunate in that sense that I wasn't waiting a long time. And then I saw the psychiatrist and he weighed me. So that was the first time I was weighed. And from there, initially he was like, you're not, he said to me, and he said to my mom, he's like, oh, we don't think it's an eating disorder. We think she's fine. And I was like, okay. So that kind of, for the eating disorder part of me, that was like a yes, like, here we go, like, this is fine.
And that was the psychiatrist
psychiatrist. Yeah, he was a locum psychiatrist at the time, and he said to me and my mother, he was like, no, we don't think it's an eating disorder, like, she's fine. And so I kind of thought after that appointment, oh, that's it, like, you know, there's nothing more here. And then a few weeks after, I got a letter to go see a counselor within that same clinic, and it's the same counselor I'm with now, so I've been seeing him for 5 years. And he was going to offer CBTE, which is cognitive behavioral therapy extended. So it's specifically for eating disorders. So at the time, me and my mum were quite confused, because the psychiatrist had said, oh, well, there's nothing wrong here. But then the counselor was offering the eating disorder treatment. So that was what happened there. But I know for some people that I do know from having met them in treatment, that they became very underweight, which led their families bringing them to the GP, where the GP weighed them, checked their bloods and all of that, and things were a bit iffy. Like, they weren't a picture of health. And that was how their route began into treatment, whereas mine wasn't like that. Do you know, like, my bloods have always been very fine. I don't really, you know, the only thing that's physically come up has been being quite underweight, and then with my bone density, so I was diagnosed with osteoporosis and osteopenia. Other than that, like, my bloods were fine. So I don't think bloods are usually a good marker of severity of an eating disorder. Things are happening underneath that go unchecked.
So at no point, you know, did the psychiatrist weigh you and say that you didn't have an eating disorder, or
yeah,
was that just a conversation?
Yeah. So at that point he had weighed me, and I was still like, I was a relatively healthy weight. I'd lost weight at that point, but I was still within what they use, the BMI, so the body mass index. And I was still like, I was good under their scale, but that was where he was like, no, it's fine. Like, she's okay. And which I think is a huge, huge fault in how eating disorders are approached. Like, if you look at the diagnostic criteria for it now, weight isn't actually brought into it, but at the time it was. There's different levels of eating disorder. So there's anorexia, there's atypical anorexia, then you have your bulimia, your EDNOS. Like, there's quite a lot to it. And at that time, I think he was just looking at these things that he had to tick off on his list, which I think was a problem, because I think I was starting to spiral quite low into that depth of becoming dangerously unwell physically. And he kind of brushed it off, and I think for me that was ammunition at the time for my eating disorder, because it was like, well, that's great, like we're fine here, it's okay, like, we can continue doing what we're doing. And I think that was quite toxic for me.
You probably walked out of that appointment and you know, your eating disorder was like, yes, we won.
Yeah exactly. It was like, yeah, we're fine, like, we can keep playing here, it's okay. And that's not what I think. Like, I had, like, I don't want to go into weight, but like it is quite a huge factor. So for someone in a high up position like that to tell someone with an eating disorder that their weight is fine or whatever, like that's just a huge no-no. Like it's so, so bad, and it's so negligent. Like it's, you know, it's setting someone up for a fall. And I think that's a huge problem in eating disorders and just how they're approached here. You know, there is that stereotype still there, and I think it's a problem.
Yeah, that's a very interesting situation to happen. It's very scary. So tell me about, because did you say you've been in treatment for a couple of years now?
Yeah, so I've done there's different types of treatment you can do. So I did outpatient treatment, and I was at that for 2 years. And, you know, like I was floating along, like it was okay. Like my life wasn't amazing. I was still quite stuck in that eating disordered mindset. And, you know, I was very frozen in time from when I'd begun to become very unwell in 2015. And at that point I was referred to check for a bone density scan, because with eating disorders, you lose your period. So that's really bad for your bone density and things like that. So it was suggested by my counselor to do that. And I did that, and I was like, oh, it's going to be fine. Like everything else is always fine. Like there's this drama queens. And we got the results back, and my spine had osteoporosis in my lower spine, and then osteopenia in my hips. So it was a massive risk for fracture. And it was at that point that I said to myself, I was like, I'm not okay. I was like, what I'm doing is not okay. I'm not treating my body properly. I said, I'm not getting adequate nutrition here. I was like, I'm destroying my body. And because I couldn't see it, it didn't faze me at the time, you know, like because I couldn't see my bone density. But when I got those scan results, I was like, I've screwed up. I was like, I've made a massive mistake here. I was like, what on earth have I done? I was like, how do I get out of this? I was like, outpatient treatment isn't working. I was like, what am I supposed to do? So I went to my counselor and I said to him, I was like, look, the scans came back. My bones are this. And he said, Jess, we're going to refer you for inpatient treatment. He's like, that's the next step. Like, you'll have 24/7 care there. And so that's what I did. And that was, I think that was 2017, maybe. And I was referred for an assessment there in John of God's in Slorgan in Dublin. And they're a fantastic hospital. And I did the admission, and the woman was like, you know, you need to come in, like, you need to be admitted, like, ASAP. But because the hospital was a private hospital, I had to get funding from the HSE. And that was where a whole other hullabaloo of stress began, because the HSE have criteria then that they judge off the severity of an eating disorder off of, and I didn't fit that, so they refused me for funding. And so then I began this limbo of being in outpatient treatment, knowing I needed inpatient treatment, because outpatient treatment just wasn't cutting it. It was like, you know, you're drowning and you're doing your best to keep above water, but it's just, it's not working. You're getting nowhere. You're still in the same spot.
Yeah.
So I got frustrated, and I was like, wait, like, why? Like, I know people who've gotten funding and they're in similar positions to I am. I was like, why have I been refused when they've gotten it? So at that point, I got on to the Minister for Mental Health at the time, Jim Daly, and I emailed his office. And they came back to me and they said what had been said at my local level about why it was refused. And I was like, I don't understand this. I was like, it makes no sense to me. I was like, how can you judge the severity of someone's psychiatric illness, which is a mental illness, off of their physical, how they are? You know, to me, it made no sense. So to be honest, I became their worst nightmare. I knew what I needed. So I kept at them. I discovered that in Ireland, the counties are divided into different CHOs. So my CHO was CHO 8. So I found out who was at the top of that, who was basically the boss of the people over my community mental health center. So I went to her and I sent her letters, I sent her everything. I requested all my files from the psych in my community, and I just became their worst nightmare until eventually they turned around and they were like, yeah, you know, this girl, she does need funding. And that was it. That was how I ended up spending 14 weeks in inpatient. So it became quite a struggle. For me, for someone who was like, oh, I'm fine, to have to argue to other people saying, yeah, yeah, you're fine, but to know I wasn't fine, it was very, very stressful. It was it was massively draining to put up this fight saying I need this, when one part of me was like, I don't need it. Like, it became very, very difficult. And I think it's unfair that they put people through that. here because they don't have the public beds for eating disorders in Ireland, unfortunately.
And how did you feel? Like, you fought so hard to get into John of God's when it's such a serious step in your recovery. How, like, did at any point, I'm always, and I know that you know this, aside from this conversation, but I'm so impressed and just blown away by your, how brave you are, and that's just an outsider looking in, because I don't know your story, or, you know, you could say, you know, well, it's to you, it doesn't feel like brave to be brave. It feels, you know, more of a necessity, you know. So how did you feel at that point where you were fighting and fighting and fighting for John of God's, because you knew that was, did you know that it was the answer, or did you actually want to walk in there the next day? Or was it a case of you didn't want to go in, but you knew that you needed to?
I think the funny thing is when I actually got to John of God's, I actually hadn't thought about being there, because I've been so driven on this path of getting the funding that I actually hadn't allowed myself to actually think of the possibility of going in there.
Yeah.
But when I got there, I was like, oh my God, what have I done? I was like, oh my God, I need to go home. I was like, I can't, because there's so many restrictions within the hospital. So you're basically not in charge of yourself anymore. Like, you're not allowed outside until you gain all of these perks, you know? And I sat there on the hospital bed and I was like, oh my God, I have to go home. I was like, what the hell have I done? Do you know, like, I hadn't thought about it till that day when I was sat on that bed and I was like, the reality hit me. I hadn't, because I didn't think it would happen. You know, the funding was refused the first time and I was like, what are the chances of it being like approved the second time? Like, you know, like in my head, I was like, it's not going to happen. But to me, I was like, it has to happen. That's why I fought so hard for it. So I was like, I think the only way to describe it was, I was going to my counseling sessions and I was like, I'll follow this meal plan when I get home. But then when I got home, I didn't have the strength within me to do it. I was just too deep in the eating disorder. Like, I needed that 24/7 care. Like, I needed the nurses and I needed that support to get to a dinner table and, you know, like, lift a fork, you know, like, things that have become so alien to me that up until that point, like, I couldn't imagine doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went in April 2019. So to me last year, I was like, if I don't get in here, I was like, and I don't do this. It was a really, really, like, depressingly low moment to look back on. But I was like, if I don't get in here and I don't do this, I was like, then what else is there? I was like, I've tried outpatient treatment. I was like, there's no other way about it. I was like, it's this or I have no life. I was like, this will kill me. I was like, I'm not going to have a life. So, like, I have to get this. And that was what drove me so much for getting it, you know? Like, so there was a lot going on there behind the scenes, a lot mentally other than the eating disorder itself. It was very much a life or death situation, I think, is the best way to describe it.
Yeah. And are you comfortable talking about what it was like in there, you know, in a general, like, perspective?
Yeah. I think, you know, the hospital was, it was fabulous. Like, I didn't really know what to think before going in. You know, I didn't really have, I suppose, much expectations. I had seen, you know, like, I'd seen movies, you know, like, or different TV shows. So I kind of had, like, that, like, that kind of, in my head, I was like, oh my God, is that what it's going to be like? But, you know, like, it was actually, it sounds terrible to describe it like a hotel, but, like, the hospital itself does look like a hotel. It doesn't look like a hospital. Like, so when me and my mom approached it, we were like, are we in the right place? Because it wasn't anywhere what we had thought it would have looked like. And we got in there and, you know, the first day, everyone was so lovely. The nurses were so sweet. My first weekend there, I cried so much that I think, like, I became dehydrated. Like, I didn't think it was physically possible to cry that much. Like, I was so terrified. But the nurses, they were just unreal. And the other patients, because obviously they had been there before me, they were so welcoming. They were so kind. And just hearing other people's stories and what had led them to getting there, being so unwell, you know, it was just, I made friends for life there that I wouldn't have if I hadn't gone there, if you get what I mean. Like, it just, I couldn't have imagined it being as it was. It was very supportive. And, like, if I hadn't gone there, like, it did, like, it helps give me back my life. Like, without it, I probably wouldn't be sitting here doing this podcast with you. Like, it's just, it's crazy. Like, I owe them so much for helping me get so well. Like, they were unreal.
Yeah. And when you go in there, are you in a routine? Like, you have to, like, so this is the way I picture it, but this is coming from an ignorant perspective. But do you have to get up? Do you have to get up at a certain time and they do certain things with you and you go to do different activities and different treatments and you eat at a certain time and you have does everybody, because eating disorders affect people in different ways as well.
Yeah, no, that's it, exactly. And because I went in, so John of God's, they're a psych hospital, so they treat various mental illnesses, you know, bipolar, schizophrenia, all of that sort of whack. But because I was on the eating disorder program, we had a set schedule. So Monday morning, 8 o'clock, you're getting weighed. That's a Monday and a Wednesday and a Friday. Then 8:30 every day, you're straight down for breakfast. 9 o'clock, you get your medication, you get your blood pressure, you get all those checks, and then you're going down to group. So on a Monday, we had goals. So we set our goals up for the week, and then we'd go to our next group. Then around, I think it was 12:45, we'd have lunch. And then we'd do another group, and we'd do post-meals. So after your two main meals, we did post-meal support. So we'd go in and we'd chat about the meal and how we felt about it. And, you know, like if we were pissed off, if we were happy with it, you know, like if we were grand. And then we'd go to our next group. And then you kind of had like free time on the ward after dinner. So dinner was 5:30 to 6:00. And then you do your post meal again. And then kind of like if you were allowed time off the ward, you were fine. You could go off down onto the grounds. There was a tennis court. There was beautiful grounds for walking and things like that. If you had certain privileges, you could go off out to Stillorgan and just go to Starbucks or whatever. But every day was very regimented. There were so many different groups. We did art, we did CBTE there as well, we did a cooking group, we did a shopping group. You know, they kept you very, very busy. And then weekends would come around and you're not so busy, and that was a whole other thing in itself. But you know, it kept you very, very busy. So it was a shock to the system coming out of treatment and not having such structured days, because it keeps you in check, like all these meals and having someone tell you, oh, at 3 o'clock, you know, you have to have your snack or whatever. So it's very, very strict and structured.
Right. And then the 14 weeks, was that kind of a prescribed 14 weeks, or was that just like, okay, now you feel like you can go?
So typically what happens is most inpatient treatment facilities is 12 weeks. Okay. So it was recommended that I stayed for longer. So they actually wanted me to stay 16 weeks, but come around week 13, 14, I was like, no, I'm really feeling like I'm okay to go home. I was like, I'm just, you know, at that point I had cabin fever. So I was like, no, like I need to go. So that was why I left at week 14. But typically it's week 12. But they had judged that I needed an extra few weeks, which is quite typical for John of God's. If they see people need extra weeks, they'll recommend it. Whereas I know other facilities don't. It's 12 weeks and that's it, which was the great part about John of God's, because it was quite, you know, it was based on the person. It wasn't just a formulated 12 weeks. You know, if they thought you needed it, you needed it. And if they thought you were doing really well and you're only on week 9, they were like, well, we suggest you do day patient. You know, so they keep you in the loop with your treatment. You know, it is very individualized, which is really, really good. And yeah. I thought that was like a great part. And like, I knew around week 12, I was like, oh, had I not gotten, because they had to apply for extra funding then, I knew if I had gone home on that week 12, it would have been a bit iffy, like, so the extra 2 weeks did help give me that extra confidence for going home. So I was happy about that, but not happy about it at the same time, because no one wants to be there any longer, you know, but if it's what they recommended. So we came to a compromise with 14 weeks as opposed to 16.
Yeah. And so now you're out, you know, over a year at this stage. How was the last
year tomorrow?
Oh, it's a year tomorrow. Oh, yeah, year interesting. Tomorrow.
I know.
Very good.
That's crazy. It doesn't feel like a year. I was thinking about it earlier. I was like, oh my God. I was like, it's been such a whirlwind of a year. It doesn't feel like it. It feels like a few weeks ago. It's surreal.
Yeah. And so what has the last 12 months looked like? I know with the lockdown and everything else has thrown you off, but just in general, how strong and confident do you feel about, you know, the last 12 months and the future as well?
I feel like it's been an up and down kind of 12 months. I came into treatment with the opinion that once I came out of treatment, I was cured. And that was stupid of me to think, because of course that's not how it works. Like, if you're going to come out of there cured, everyone's going to go in there. Like, I was very naive of me to think like, but I suppose I had put all my eggs in that basket because I had, I had such a fight to get there. Mm. But over the last 12 months, it's been up and down. Like, there's this quote that I see, and a lot of people say it to me. They're like, recovery isn't linear. So there is its ups and downs. But I think when I think back to before I went into treatment, I think life is definitely much better than it was. You know, like this week alone, I think I went to Dublin, went to Pogue, got an acai bowl, and then went to Wagamama's after. And to me, even one of those things would have been terrifying a year and a half ago. So to be able to do that is a huge, huge achievement. And like, I feel very hopeful that I can kick this in the bud, that it's not going to be, like the ball and chain that keeps me from living my life. So I think despite the ups and downs of the last year, which, it'd be wrong of me to say, oh yeah, it's been a great year, because it doesn't work like that. And that's just giving people with eating disorders false hope. Like, it's not like all rainbows and sunshines. There is, like, it's very, very difficult thing to recover from. Like, it is very, very hard. But I think had lockdown not happened when it did, I think that was kind of the slap in the face. I think things would have been much better. Like, I think I would have kept continuing, but because that came, and I think for a normal person that was quite tough anyway, regardless of whether you have previous experiences with mental illness or whatever, it was really, really tough. So if you add in existing mental illness on top of that and think of how a normal person would have felt versus someone with whatever they have anyway, it was really, really difficult. And I think that set me back a bit, but now that we've come out of lockdown and stuff, I think things are definitely much better. Like, they've improved. I've gotten rid of things that would have been very much eating disorder based, like scales and a Fitbit and things like that. They're completely gone now. They're not being entertained anymore. So lockdown was good for reflection, but it was also really, really tricky. And I think for anyone, everyone struggled with it. And I don't think any amount of time in treatment or whatever would have prepared anyone for, a worldwide pandemic. It wasn't on anyone's radar. And I think having the correct coping skills and being able to deal with that, I suppose it was a real test and a real challenge for what I'm able to deal with in life. And, being able to survive that, I think for everyone is a huge thing. So for me to say, oh yeah, I got through like something that was so terrifying to me and got out the other side, I can keep at this, I can keep doing what I need to do, I can go out and eat dinner with my friends, drink champagne, all those fun things that I strived for when I was in a hospital. Because I have a journal with like a load of little things on it where, like, this time last year, goals for me were going to Pogue or, going to Happy Pair, things like that, and they're being ticked off. So I think that's, to me, that's good. I think that's really nice. like those little things. So
yeah, a lot of the time it takes writing down those little goals to actually go back and see. There's such power in that, to go back and see, okay, you don't feel like you've made much progress, or you might not feel like you're on the right track, but you go back and you look at those goals and you're like, oh my God, I really did tick everything off. Yeah. And it feels, now I feel like I know I'm going in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I would recommend that to anyone, like, even to someone who doesn't have an eating disorder, to, sit down and once or twice a month, just journal a little and see what you want to achieve. Because I journaled the whole time I was in hospital. So I was setting my goals and the things that, in my wildest dreams, I'd love to be able to doing in like a year or so's time. And to be able to look at that and go, actually, do you know what? I did that. I've done that. Like, I had a list of even places I want to travel, and Copenhagen was on that. And I was like, wait, I've done that. It's amazing how much can change if you put the work in. Like, you have to be working on your recovery. You can't take your eye off the ball. Like, it's constant. You're constantly working on it. And I think that was where I struggled with when I came out of hospital, because I was like, I'm fine. Like, it's okay. I don't need to be so like regimented about this and stuff. And that's not the case. You do need to keep keep your eye on the ball, you know, like don't take your finger off the pulse. You know, they prescribe a meal plan and things like that for a reason, because they help. That's the medication. So I think now that I know that, and I had that bit of a fall, that I can just pick myself up from it and know what I need to do to keep going, to keep staying healthy, that kind of way.
Yeah. And well, first of all, it's just such an inspiration just to the realness of you talking about the last 12 months. I can't believe it's tomorrow. I was thinking that it was earlier in this year that it was your 12-month mark, but that's really, really interesting that it's tomorrow. And like your honesty just about, you know, it's not a linear approach and, you know, it hasn't been easy, but you set your goals and you're just maintaining them and to keep working in the right direction is just like so inspirational. And to somebody, again, to somebody looking inward to you, it's like, to me, that sounds like the most you could have ever asked for. Despite the lockdown, it's like it was never going to be, oh, you're cured, you know, once you finish treatment, but you know, you're obviously on the right track. The last question I wanted to ask you was, I suppose if anybody, this might catch attention of people who are, you know, concerned about somebody that's close to them that might have an eating disorder. How would you, do you have any advice to give them? And maybe, I know you said your mom, you know, she had a conversation with you, you had a close friend talk to your mom. Do you have any advice for anybody in that situation?
I think if it's your friend, I think definitely say, you know, you don't seem yourself. You seem a bit stressed. Is everything okay? I think it's important to not, I think a lot of mistakes people make is they comment on the appearance. And for someone with an eating disorder, that's just, I suppose, like giving sugar to a child, you know, like they thrive off of that. I think don't comment on the appearance. I think go in with your concerns, being like, oh, you seem a bit withdrawn, you know, like you're not really hanging out with us a bit more, you know, like just go in with how they've changed, or be like, oh, you seem a bit, you know, you seem a bit picky about food, like is everything okay there? Or, you know, you're going to the gym a lot, like is that all right? Like, should you be doing it that much? Do you think maybe you should take a break? And if they seem like a bit on the offensive about things like that, definitely encourage them to go to their GP or to check out Bodywise. If you get like a Bodywise leaflet or something like that, get them onto that, because Bodywise is fantastic. They have so much great resources on there, and they do, like, if a friend or a family member isn't quite comfortable with going to speak to someone in person, Bodywise do an online chat where you can just talk and get support in that way, and like a help, like a really helpful environment. So that's a good first step. I think that's what I would recommend. And just for family, because they're around them the whole time, if it's someone under 18, like if it's a daughter or a son or something like that, you're in a position where you can bring them to the GP and be like, you know, I think something needs to be checked out here. You know, I think things aren't wrong. You know, if you have a gut instinct, go with it, because you don't want to let these things go on for so long. Because I think with an eating disorder, because they're so behavioral based and you're doing these different actions and stuff, that the longer it goes on, the harder it is to break those actions. You know, like once you learn to cycle a bike, that's it, you know, you're cycling a bike. But if you're doing these behaviors and you're, that you're doing like walking or whatever, and that becomes so second nature to you, that if that goes on for the guts of, you know, like a year, 2 years, it's very, very hard to break that. So you, like, if it's a family member or a friend and these are sudden new changes that you're noticing, get in there quick. Don't let it spiral out of control where it gets to a point where it's difficult to break those behaviors. And because that's what they say early intervention is key, and that's why, it's because of those behaviors and because of those different things that you do within the eating disorder, they become so hard to break, you know, like just, it becomes ingrained in you at that point. And I think that's hugely important.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, not to go in with the physical appearance, because it's like that's kind of what the eating disorder wants, isn't it?
Yeah, thrives on it. Yeah, like if someone said to me, oh, you don't look great, I'd be like, okay. I'm like, yeah, that's okay. You know, like, to me, I was, that didn't deter me, you know. I was like, okay, like whatever, you know. Or if someone would say, oh, like you seem really tired, or like, you know, like just you look rubbish, you know, like in a negative aspect, I was like, oh, okay, right, wait, wait, what? Do you know,
that maybe kind there's of something wrong here.
I think going in the other way, especially if you're making comments about weight and things like that, like the eating disorder loves that. Like, that's just, it's, I don't think it's good. And I think people might disagree with me on that, but that's just what I've found and what I know from other people with eating disorders, what they've said. So I wouldn't approach it that way. I'd approach it in a different way.
Well, thank you so much, and congratulations on your 12-month mark.
Amazing
achievement, and it's, even though it probably doesn't feel like it because it's been such an up and down, as you described, bumpy road, but it just is insane to look back on. I'm sure you're appreciative of all the journals that you kept and all the goals that you set, and just kind of all those little tiny wins along the way, because they you're looking back and they all add up.
Yeah, they do. They become, like, even something so simple like going to Tesco now, it's like, oh my god, like, that's second nature to me now. Like, and a year and a half ago it was terrifying, you know. So little things like that, they really help when you feel like, oh, like, I'm not improving, or I'm not recovering, or I'm not getting any better. Like, they really, really help. You know, it just, I think it helps you see it from a different perspective.
Yeah. Well, Jess, I know that you also share some content on Instagram, so I definitely want to plug that in the description box as well, to just direct people if they want to connect with you. And you kind of provide a resource for people that might be going through something similar, or just to really raise awareness, because that's, again, a huge part of what we're trying to do today. And yeah, I know it's kind of part of your mission. So we appreciate all the openness, because it takes, again, it's, you're so brave to be open and honest about your whole experience, because it just hasn't been easy, and it's still not easy for you. So, you know, you have to recognize that as well. So really, really appreciate that, and appreciate your time coming on today to chat about everything.
Thank you. And thank you for inviting me on. I was so chuffed. I was like, this is a great way now to hopefully raise some much needed awareness, because I think you have such a great, you know, you have such a good platform, and, you know, to see you be so interested in helping me share this, you know, I was really, really happy about that. I was delighted. So thank you for that.
Oh, of course.